Hello, I'm Sandy Toksvig. Thank you for joining me for the third episode of the News Quiz Extra. You get a great deal here at the News Quiz. Buy one, get one free. Well, I presume that's why the producer has written bog off all over my script. We like to give you a little extra for your money, and it doesn't cost us anything. Just throw Jeremy a few more peanuts, and he'll talk for hours. Over to the show.
We present the News Quiz with your host, Sandy Toksvig.
Hello and welcome to the News Quiz. We start with a cutting from the North Devon Gazette, read by Corrie Caulfield.
Drug-proof your children. Steer them away from the harmful use of drugs, including alcohol, at one of our free taster sessions.
And our thanks to Martin Cassini for sending that in. Now let's meet the teams. Will you welcome first, on my right, the almost irreplaceable Jeremy Hardy and the almost invisible Susan Kalman. And on my left, making her first appearance on the show, journalist and broadcaster Julia Hartley Brewer. And we thought we'd pair her with a wise old sage. Well, one out of three isn't bad. It's Andy Hamilton. Jeremy, who's been all jaw-jaw about more war?
David Cameron. Well, this show is recorded. I'm sorry to disappoint the audience listening at home, to the home service. This show was recorded in 1946. David Cameron was just making his speech as I left the building in which I was watching it and walked over the road to Broadcasting House in London's swinging London Quarter. I caught the gist of it. And what he said was, the war in Libya was a wizard whiz, because Tories love war. It's their bestest, most favourite thing. They get all that hormonal rush and they start getting out their old copies of The Victor and Biggles tackles the public sector and things like that. And he had nothing to say about the Palestinian bid for statehood, which they've been waiting for since Britain picked up the remnants of the Ottoman Empire in 1918. In fact, he had nothing to say about that, despite the fact that nobody has ever questioned Israel's right to take part in the Eurovision Song Contest.
Maybe the UN could adopt a one-in-one-out policy. Maybe quite a good way to get rid of France. What is full membership of the UN? How does that work? Like, without it, can you not use the sauna with Russia? How does it work? Cameron was basically saying that Libya was a good idea. Is that the? But we didn't really intervene. We did some
bombing.
He's just quite excited. It's exactly what you see. He's enjoying it. Him and Nicky Sarkozy went on a lad's tour. I think they got T-shirts printed or they went to Libya. They got excited. The only other time I've seen a look of excitement in the way that they had was women at a shoe sale. And I accidentally went into a shoe shop once when there was a shoe sale on, and it was really quite frightening, actually. I had to use some quite nifty self-defence techniques, and I just wanted a pair of Dr. Scholl sandals, but I had to go past the kitten heels and almost had a perforated eardrum.
See, I stopped listening after you'd said Dr. Scholl's, because I was trying to think the last time I saw a pair of Dr. Scholl's.
Randy, you are Britain's most beloved lesbian. Don't tell us you don't know what Dr. Scholl's are. As though, Sandy is wearing Manolo Blahnik heels.
She must know about it, because there's actually a model of Dr. Scholl sandals named after you, the Toksvig. There is. Very popular.
Do you know, there is a paint named after me, and I wrote and complained because it's pink. It's true.
It's a paint.
There's a paint, yes.
Would you want a nice sort of plaid?
Could you get plaid paint? Well, let's wait a minute. Let's ask our Scotch expert.
Yes, you can. Why would you not want a pink paint?
I don't know. It just looked a bit dull, I thought. It was that sort of Suffolk pink. It didn't feel me, but they weren't interested.
This happens to prime ministers, though. This happens to every prime minister, doesn't it? And I think Susan's right. I think it's the effect of cheering crowds, because they're deeply unpopular here. They go to Libya and they're greeted as saviours. And I think part of Cameron thought, yes, I am the saviour. Then he makes a speech saying that we should attack tyrants who persecute their own people. The Russians would probably veto that, I think. And I don't think he would get Parliament to support a war with China. I think that would be... Or it would need one hell of a dossier, I tell you that.
Did you see Tony Blair was in New York as well, in his role as the Middle East peace envoy?
A man who's not troubled by irony in any way whatsoever.
I'm the only person, I think, in the world that he hasn't had a secret meeting with yet. He's had secret meetings with Gaddafi, he's having secret meetings with Cameron.
Do you have oil?
You've got a beard.
I've got... Yeah, yeah, I get beard oil. That must be economically viable, I would have thought.
You'd make a great dictator.
Thank
you.
I
mean that in a nice way.
Yeah, no, I would. You lot would all be dead for a start.
David Cameron gave a speech to the United Nations calling for more intervention against oppressive regimes, citing the success of the rebels in Libya. Cameron also had a rare face-to-face meeting with Barack Obama when he took the opportunity to ask all those questions he's been meaning to ask, like, what's it like being you? And in America, what do you call chips? 2 points to Jeremy. Susan, who talked for 45 minutes without mentioning his partner?
This was Nick Clegg at the Liberal Democrats conference, which I watched. It had a slightly depressing air about it. Kind of like if you go to a wedding and the bride doesn't turn up, but you all decide to have the reception anyway because you've made the vol-au-vents. It was kind of just a load of people milling around going, well, we've paid for it, we may as well enjoy it. So Nick Clegg came out and did his keynote speech, which was 45 minutes long. He didn't mention Cameron once. I think he mentioned the Conservatives a couple of times. And it was quite sad watching, actually, because, you know, he was kind of going, it's all right, I'm sorry, it's going to be okay, sorry. And it kind of reminded me of those adverts, you know, those Dogs Trust adverts you see on television?
Oh, yeah.
Where you see a wee dog and the voiceover just goes, could you love Nick Clegg? For £5 a month, you could help Nick Clegg. He'll send you a picture and a card on your birthday.
But you're right. I mean, it was exactly like a groom speaking at a wedding reception and not mentioning the wife at any point whatsoever. And in fact, he talked about possible coalition in the future with Labour, so it was like not mentioning your wife, but suggesting you were thinking of sleeping with the woman next door. I mean, it was sort of...
My favourite bit of Nick Clegg's speech was when he talked about his passion, because Tony Blair had education, 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 and David Cameron famously said, I don't need three words, I need three letters, NHS. And Nick Clegg, I have to read this, he said, for seven words, ensuring a fair start for every child. And I'm quite hopeful, I think it means we're all going to go to public school, we're all going to go to Cambridge, and we're all going to get work experience at our dad's bank. Great start for everyone.
It's wonderful that he chose something so controversial to pin his hopes on.
Yes.
He's
yes.
very, very passionate about jobs. In fact, I think he should ask for one.
What struck me about Clegg's speech is that he's developed a lot of Tony Blair's rhetorical devices. For instance, does he like to frame everything in the form of a question? Yes, he does. Does he constantly ask himself questions to which he already knows the answer? Yes, he does. Is it intensely annoying? Yes, it is. Would it be better if he asked more interesting questions, like who won the cup in 1959? Yes, it would. Is it Nottingham Forest? Yes, it is. That would be... If he's going to use that rhetorical device... But Vince Cable was my personal highlight, because he tried to frighten us.
Yeah, he was scary.
He did the political equivalent of holding a torch under your chin. And he said that this was the economic equivalent of wartime, which I presume is just bluster. If it's not bluster, then they should stop fanning around with, you know, quantitative easing and stuff and bring in radical wartime economic measures, shouldn't they?
What, like dried egg?
Like dried egg, rationing, turning off the streetlights, shooting deserters or tax exiles, as they like to be called. If it's genuinely that bad, that's the sort of stuff we should have.
I'm willing to give my pants for parachutes.
Yes, disproving the theory that nature abhors a vacuum, it's Nick Clegg's speech at the Liberal Democrat conference, during which he failed to mention David Cameron even once. Oh, if only it was as easy to erase that tattoo on his thigh.
Now I've got an image in my head.
Oh, sorry.
Nick Clegg's thigh.
Yeah. Is it inner or outer? Where have you gone?
Oh,
God. Clegg said that Lib Dems need to be not just stopping bad things, but doing good things. He later revealed himself to be pro-kittens. 2 points to Susan. Julia, which country is poorer because their standards have slipped?
Well, Italy has had their credit rating downgrade by Standard & Poor's, and Silvio Berlusconi is quite unhappy about it. I'm surprised, really, he's got time to be unhappy about it. I mean, I've always been impressed with the fact that he's been able to do to the Italian economy what he's done to those girls at the Bunga Bunga parties. I'm just impressed with Silvio Berlusconi. He runs Italy, he runs Italian television, and he manages the sex parties. I mean, a man who can multitask, you know, what's to dislike?
I find it all really complicated. I hate all this financial thing. Apparently we're going to experience a double-dip recession. What is that, where the orange sherbet isn't as good as the lemon? I don't know. Do you know that the European country that has had the healthiest growth is Belgium, which hasn't had a government for a year? I'm just saying, you know.
Standard & Poor's,
yeah,
they gave a clean bill of health to the Lehman Brothers. So really they should be substandard and very poor, shouldn't they?
It's a terrible name for it. Do you think it was a Mr. Poor?
It used to be a double act in the 70s, Tommy Standard and Bobby Poor.
Standard & Poor's said that one of the reasons they were downgrading Italy was because of a lack of financial competence in government. But he's got a team of pretty high-powered financial advisors, pretty astute. Because, I mean, nobody, let's face it, nobody is going to have a more realistic view of how the market works than prostitutes and blackmailers.
Yeah. They're being sued because they've copied Strictly Come Dancing. That's what I took from that.
Who are?
Berlusconi's television company
is
being sued.
In what way? With the dancing or with having some old man with his carer looking after him?
Paid Strictly Come Dancing in Italy, but not paid. And I think it'd be really quite sweet if what actually brought down Berlusconi's government was Strictly Come Dancing. It's like Al Capone and the whole kind of tax thing that brought him down. It, you know, Berlusconi's like, nobody can... I don't, that's French. Hold on, I can do accents. Nobody can... No, same one. hold on, hold on. Nobody can touch me, right? And... Scots Italian. I think that'd be a fitting end.
You don't want to be the BBC person that has to go and enforce this. They are so going to wake up with half a horse's head in their bed. For an extra point, why are the Fed doing the twist?
It's some financial manoeuvre where they print more money or something.
It's called Operation Twist Redux.
Buy short and sell long.
Yeah.
Or sell short and buy long.
Well, thank God you're not in charge. Credit rating agency Standard & Poor's have downgraded Italy's credit rating from A+ to A, while the UK is now forecast to only grow by 1.1% this year. I have to admit, I pay very little attention to growth forecasts. Never did me any good. 2 points to Julia. Andy, who is schooled in the art of hiding information?
It's Michael Gove.
Yes.
There is a controversy brewing about ministers concealing information in private email accounts, and in so doing, they're thwarting people who are making requests under the Freedom of Information Act. I mean, personally, I've never really seen the point of the Freedom of Information Act. If we want to find out the contents of ministers' private emails, we just ask News International, surely.
The email account was the name of Mrs. Blurt.
Mrs. what?
Michael Gove's private account is in the name of Mrs. Blurt, which I think tells us more about his weekend than we wish to know, but...
he is the sort of person that would have private emails, because you know that he's got a whole private world of his own, Michael Gove. You know that he goes home every night and lines all his toys up and then talks to them. And that he's got a special magic world in the back of his wardrobe behind all the coats.
Andy Burnham, who is the Shadow Education Secretary, said that Michael Gove was showing an arrogant disregard for the processes of government. And you do wonder, don't you, when you look at Michael Gove, if he didn't one day go to a plastic surgeon and say, I wonder if you could do me a look of arrogant disregard.
But it's all about the free schools, isn't it? The schools are going to be so free that we're not allowed to know anything about what they're about. Well, and I think the ministers should actually have to think out loud. They should actually
what, like a bubble
yeah, they
over
should
their
actually,
heads?
Yeah.
Because this do you not think with some of them, though, you just see tumbleweed going past?
I think they're all just probably asking if they can ask Chris Hoon's wife to take the penalty points.
She wasn't happy, was she?
She doesn't do a happy face, though, Chris Hoon's ex.
Does she not?
To be fair, what's worse, being Chris Hoon's ex or being Chris Hoon's wife?
That's one of those games you play, isn't it, at parties? OK, you have to pick one.
The thing that offended me about this particular story, and I have a slight investment in it, in that freedom of information was my speciality when I was a lawyer, so I actually think it does a lot of good, and it's something that I'm very interested in, is that I know that they think we are quite stupid, but this is horrifically stupid. I mean, it's the equivalent of saying in a freedom of information request, could you please tell me your plans for holding of terrorist suspects, and them going, oh, I'm sorry, we did it on Fuzzy Felt. We can't show you that. The arrogance of these people who think they can circumvent legislation that has been fought long and hard for to get some form of information out of the government about how they spend the money. If they just put in a stupid email account, they don't need to hand over any information. I actually think that's one of the most offensive things that I've ever heard, because any other job, if I was sending emails using other email accounts, I would be fired, and I think that's what should happen to him.
Michael Gove and his advisers have been accused of using private email accounts to discuss education policy in an attempt to bypass civil servants and the Freedom of Information Act. Tony Blair believed that the Freedom of Information Act was one of his greatest mistakes. And lest we forget, this was a man who'd married Cherie. At the end of round one, the scores are Jeremy and Susan have got 4 points, but in the lead are Julia and Andy with 5. Jeremy, why has 9 times 999 added up to an unexpected 469 million?
Well, when New Labour got in, they got very excited about what the Tories had started, which was the PFI, which was bringing private money needlessly into the public sector, which would only in the end cost the public sector more. And they sort of looked at the fire service and they thought, well, this works, we pay people to put out fires. How can we complicate it? And so Prescott came up with some ideas, one of which was, let's get them to use Perrier to put out the fires. And they settled on this thing of closing down 46 fire control centres and replacing them with 9 super ones with new computers and stuff like that. And they didn't realise that the old system of people ringing up and saying, my house is on fire, can you please put it out, worked perfectly well. Because they thought, no, computers are better because they've got games and Facebook and stuff like that. And the firefighters said, don't do this, it's not going to work. And Prescott said, shut up, what do you know, you miserable firefighting nerds. All you do, you killjoys, you're spoiling it for everybody. And he went ahead. And the firefighter said, it's not going to work. Look, just let us put the fires out. Just let us get on with it. And he said, no, no, you're going to have computers. The best way to put a fire out is to throw an old Amstrad on it. That's the thing to do. And it hasn't worked. It's costing millions of pounds because we're still paying for all these empty things like we are all the NHS PFI nonsense.
There are 9 buildings which are empty and they're costing £4 million a month. And I had a great idea. Why don't we set fire to 8 of them and get the 9th one to put it out?
It's the madness of employing consultants, isn't it? Because consultants are paid money to come in and assess your system. I mean, when has a consultant ever said, you know what, your system's fine.
Yeah,
it's
sure.
Really good. You know, that Labour government was shot through with this obsession with consultants. And everywhere they go, they just leave these ambitious, grandiose... My theory is it's Stonehenge, right? There was a druid and there was a consultant there and he said, we thought we'd just have a nice little stone bench.
What is the problem with government IT projects? Because, say, whether it's fire service, whether it's the NHS computer, the £12 billion down the drain, none of their IT systems ever work. And I've wondered, has anyone ever just said, have you tried turning it off and turning it on again? Because that works for me every time.
Because this IT system, apparently if you logged on, a little paperclip used to appear and say, it looks like you're on fire, do you need some help?
Whenever you see now that someone's installing a new IT system, it's the equivalent in a horror film of someone saying, I'm just popping down to the basement.
How hard can it be? You pick up the phone, you dial 999, and they say, which service? You shout the word fire down the phone. They say, where's your house? You say, Blackpool. And they patch you through to the Blackpool fire service. What did they think the computer was going to do that was going to speed that up?
But did you not think that when you dialed 999 you got some specialist? Because, in fact, you get a BT operator. Well, at least it's not 118 118. Honestly, I'd rather burn.
Oh, I know what they were going to do. They were going to bring in a system like they have in cinemas, wouldn't they? Oh. So your house is on fire. They say, where's your house? And you'd say, Blackpool. They say, your house is on fire in Blackburn. Yeah. And you go, Blackpool. Yeah, your house is on fire in Blackheath. And you just fry.
In theatres, they have a code word. In case there's a fire, they don't want to panic the audience. And so always in the dressing rooms, they have a thing up that tells you what the code word is, and it'll be, Mr. Sands is the code word. So you might hear an announcement, Mr. Sands to the foyer. And that means that the foyer is on fire. And I was playing in one theatre, and I always have a look for the code word. And I think they hadn't completely understood the system because their code word was Mr. Panic.
When you hear the words, Mr. Sands is spreading through the theatre like wild sands. And the sands doors are locked.
A project to set up regional control centres for fire and rescue services in England has been called a complete failure by MPs after it was found to have wasted £469 million. The plan was to scrap 46 local services and replace them with 9 centralised headquarters, with the rest of the money spent on longer hoses. They're now calling them white elephants. And actually, that would have been better. Would have been better because they can do that water spraying thing and get people out of second floor windows quite easily, I would have thought. 2 points to Jeremy. Susan, who spends too much time being nursed through theory?
Nurses.
2 points. Julia, sorry.
The president of the Royal College of Nursing has suggested that nurses are not caring enough because they spend most of their time in lecture theatres learning about how to be a nurse rather than learning how to care like a nurse. And I think the fundamental issue is that many people believe they could be doctors or nurses from watching the television. For example, me. Because... a well-known obsession with the television programme Casualty. I think it's absolutely outstanding. It's the best programme on television. Anyone who says it's not is wrong. I was particularly delighted last Saturday. I watched it and I diagnosed the condition before the doctors. Now, I did a lap of honour around the flat, right? I don't know who I was competing against, apart from myself, but that boy went up a ladder and I said, there's something going to happen here. Because nobody just goes up a ladder in Casualty. There's always something happening. He had a petit mal seizure. Now, as it happened, I shouted, it's a seizure, right? And I won. Now, the point is... I've been watching Casualty now for, I don't know how many, 16 years or something like that. I've got them all on video. I have sufficient medical knowledge, I believe, to be a doctor. I was actually, true story, and it was just an unconscious thing. Don't blame me. I was on a train and an announcement went over. Is there a doctor on the train? And I stood up.
Did anybody notice?
And my better half put one of those kind, you know, when someone puts a kind hand on your shoulder. That's forceful, yet not a punch, yet. And went, Susan, you're not a doctor. And I went, just because I don't have a piece of paper doesn't mean I'm not a doctor. The point is, people like me are the problem. Yeah. Right?
Susan, with your diagnostic skills, have you ever come across the term Munchausen syndrome?
Yes. Munchausen's by proxy. I know them all.
I don't think the diagnoses are that difficult. I haven't watched Casualty for years, but
don't you?
I've probably seen 10 episodes, and at least 9 of them, the kid fell on railings, and the diagnosis was railing through body.
If I could just recommend, you're starting out. If you want to start with doctors, because that's also a very good programme. It's more of a GP-based one, so it's more minor ailments and sprains. And if you were... What you'll learn then is a lot of the names of the drugs that they routinely diagnose. So if you
it's
want
like
to go
being
and
on a mental health ward.
Do you watch Holby as well?
Stop her now!
No. One of the complaints was that people are learning off DVDs, isn't it? So there are nurses who think that nursing is about telling gas explosion victims how to break the news to their parents that they're gay. That's what you. That's what the nurses do. They don't do any nursing in casualty, do they? They always resolve a massive emotional
crisis.
That's
what I like, though. There's always a moral message at the end of it. You know, it's always like, you know, bringing people together and stuff. I don't like Hobo City. It's not very realistic.
According to the Royal College of Nursing, many new nurses are incapable of caring for patients because they've spent too much time in the classroom and not enough on the wards. In addition, untrained assistants have apparently been performing a number of specialist procedures. This is part of the NHS new Go On, Have a Go initiative. By 2013, all nurses must have a degree, and I'm going to assume it's in nursing. Somebody with a theology degree saying, I don't know what I'm doing, but you're going to a better place. Two points to Susan, Julia. Who wants to put the great back into Britain?
The Prime Minister, David Cameron, on his little trip abroad. Yes, he's launched a £500,000 campaign to give a boost to British tourism and British business, this whole image of our country. It's not just about the royal family, it's not just about royal weddings, not just about double-decker buses and bowler hats. No, it's about so much more. But the idea is that we've had this really negative image because of the scenes of rioting, binge drinking, all that, and we're going to go for a different image. But whenever I hear about plans for, you know, extra tourists to come to Britain, I always think, yeah, the last time that I was on the tube or the train or the bus or I was walking along London Street, what I was thinking is, this would be so much better if there were more people here.
More tourists, yeah. Mm. Stopping at the bottom of escalators. How fatal is that?
And wearing turquoise and purple in the same outfit. Very disturbing.
Hilariously reading bus timetables is always my favourite.
He's using this thing about Great Britain, ignoring the fact that it's only called Great Britain under the Act of Union of 1700.
Well, actually, it's also a contraction. It's Greater Britain. The original thing is Greater Britain, which suggests somewhere there's a Lesser Britain.
Well, there is, Basingstoke.
Oh, yeah.
It could have been worse. At least it was spelt G-R-E-A-T on the posters. It could have been G-R on the number 8. And then we'd all have to do the Harry Carey thing.
Oh, they'll get round
but
to that.
They will. The poster themselves, so it is kind of textbook, because the great is in capitals.
Great
Britain. And that's, of course, shouting. That's like having a drunk person outside a kebab shop going, it's great!
It's important to tell people, if they're writing a letter or an email, that putting something in capitals and underlining it doesn't add emphasis, it just means you're mental.
Now, Andy, you know about football, don't you? One of the posters apparently depicts a match between Manchester City and Fulham Athletic. And my
no,
boys...
not Fulham Athletic. There's no team called Fulham Athletic.
Oh, is there not?
No.
It's Fulham. Is there one called Fulham?
Yeah.
OK, so Manchester City owned by an Emirati... Fulham owned by an Egyptian.
Yes.
And apparently the picture shows an Argentinian scoring against an American.
Yeah. I'm going to add the name Athletic after every football team now because it was so sweet, Sandy.
I don't get football.
How
big? How big is that goal? The hole is about 18 foot. Honestly, his only job is to stop the ball going in there. And he gets paid a shed load of money and he can't do it. I just don't get it. It just seems ridiculous. If he's one side, just kick it the other side. I don't understand. I hate football.
Well, the next England manager sorted.
Yeah.
If he was a real man, he'd build a fence there, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
But, I mean, one of the posters, because the word great is at the top, isn't it? Great for shopping.
Yeah.
Which we are, well,
shopping.
Free if you come during the riot. It'll open us up to a legal challenge as well, surely, because a tourist comes here and has a crap time. So it's Trades Descriptions Act, isn't it? We'll have to change it to moderately OK.
Mustn't grumble, Britain. The government has spent £500,000 launching a new tourism and investment drive under the brand Great Britain. There is much to celebrate in the UK. Next year, the London Olympics coincides with the Queen's Diamond Jubilee, and to celebrate, Her Majesty will be running the women's 5,000-metre steeplechase.
Oh, that would be...
The campaign includes a series of postcards. Have they not heard of email? The postcards show scenes from British life, including a railway viaduct, Wallace and Gromit, and 2 8-year-old boys fighting in a cage. Makes you proud. 2 points to Julia. Andy, which council has been accused of losing the plot?
Southwark.
Yes.
2 points. Okay. Their November the 5th event, instead of being a bonfire night, so Guy Fawkes, is the Festival of the Colour Thief.
It's the Colour Thief, a winter extravaganza celebrating the change of the seasons.
No, no, you've got that wrong.
Oh.
It's the Colour Thief, colon.
Oh.
A winter extravaganza celebrating the change of the season. Someone probably spent a whole week thinking up that colon.
That'll be a consultant's colon.
Yeah.
Anyway, everyone's up in arms and saying it's a disgraceful lapse of tradition. I mean, I must admit, I'm not a big fan of these big municipal bonfire nights. I hanker after the good old days, you know, when bonfire night, you had your own fireworks, you know, and you went out with a couple of bangers and blinded a couple of your friends. So I miss that. It was good for kids because they learnt about evaluating risk. But I think they've now said that it was only a proposal.
All these stories are, you couldn't make it up, and they're normally made up. And they and there was one about Birmingham, which was complete fabrication, that Birmingham was abolishing... I tell you what, they're abolishing Christmas up there, the Brahmins, they're abolishing it because it offends the Muslims, and they're going to make a law that everyone's got to be blind. That's what they're doing up there. Yeah. And Birmingham never banned Christmas. The Winterval was to cover a whole thing to bring tourists to Birmingham, God help them. Because Christmas itself, because people are going about, oh, traditions, this is a Christian country, which basically means I'm white and I think that's an achievement. And, people say, oh, this is a Christian country, we should be celebrating Christian thing. And the fact is, Christmas is a cut-and-paste, multicultural Mithras. Festival. It's a bit of Saturnalia, it's a bit of Hanukkah, and it's a bit of pagan solstice, because Christianity is basically just a mishmash of other things, older religions.
Mithras, they used to bring trees in, didn't they? Christmas from
Britain.
It was the ancient Zoroastrian festival of arguing bitterly and your brother choosing that day to announce his transvestism to the family. And at the Phoenician version of Christmas, somebody would always announce that they would become a vegetarian. And your mother would make a turkey omelette in their honour.
It must not be allowed to happen for a very selfish reason, this eroding away of Guy Fawkes Night. And it's a very selfish reason. It's a very simple reason, because no one ever forgets my birthday because it's the day after Guy Fawkes Day. And so I do the rhyme, remember the 5th of November because it's the day before Susan's birthday. And that's how people remember.
Except and on February alone when there are 24.
One of the people who's genuinely upset by this. I hate this idea of Winterval, and I hate the idea of Guy Fawkes Night being the colour thief knife. These are British traditions. If burning Catholics isn't a key part of British tradition, what is?
Next they'll be saying I'm not allowed to dress up in a bowler hat and an orange sash. March around the streets banging a drum.
I know, because the orange man have always said, that's our tradition, and you think, yeah, but it's not very good, is it?
Southwark Council has faced claims of political correctness after it rebranded its Guy Fawkes celebrations as The Colour Thief, a winter extravaganza celebrating the change of the seasons. Yes, it's political correctness gone differently sane. According to the Daily Mail, Guy Fawkes must be turning in his grave. Well, if he hadn't been, you know, hung, drawn, quartered. Tricky manoeuvre. The new name is intended to reflect the changing of the seasons. What seasons? It's England. There's winter, one hot day in August, and then it's winter again. A spokesman for the campaign against political correctness said, I hate myself, my job, and the world. Okay, I was pre-seeing. Anyway, at the end of round two, the scores are Jeremy and Susan have got 8 points, but still in the lead are Julia and Andy with 9. Before we start round three, here is a cutting from the Sunday Times.
A Hampshire council is to hold a frank, fun and factual interactive session designed to inform local pensioners about the truth of sex in later years. Proof of age will be required.
Now, thanks to Beryl Finney for sending us that. Susan, whose need for speed is tantamount to greed?
This is one of those lovely surveys that pops up occasionally that tells us things that we didn't really need to know or want to know, which is that apparently we're getting less patient. Yeah, there you go.
Get on with it.
Yep. A couple of interesting things, Jeremy, if you'd just give me a second. Scottish people are less patient than anyone else in the United Kingdom, apparently. We want instant gratification. We hate waiting for things. Specifically, we wait less time on the phone. We'll only wait 5 minutes 30 seconds. If we're in a queue in a supermarket, we'll wait 6 minutes 30 seconds. Apparently, I don't know why anyone would flame in time anyone. I wouldn't have the patience.
are Scottish people less patient because 6 minutes is a much greater proportion of their life expectancy?
That's why you deep fry stuff, isn't it? Because if you went into a restaurant and you said, how long would the slow-cooked shoulder of lamb be? That's about 8 hours, sir. Just chuck it in the fat, for God's sake. I can't even wait, Arun.
I don't think, though, it's that we've become less patient. I think that queuing now takes longer. I always think if there weren't teenagers on the till to whom I have to describe every single piece of fruit and vegetable and what it is... I honestly always feel like Walter Raleigh introducing the potato when I...
I don't think it's true that people... Because people would rather queue for an hour than go to the self-checkout thing. And then a man has to come and tell you because you've put an unexpected item in the bagging area. And it says, are you using your own bags? And then...
I quite like it at 43 that I still have someone to come over and check that I'm old enough to buy alcohol. That makes me feel quite good.
I think it's like a conversation. It's someone talking to me.
Susan, you know that money you're winning on the cash point machines? That's your money. And when they say, would you like cash back? That's your money as well.
The thing is, we are so addicted to queuing in this country that my favourite scene from the August riots was the scene of the looters queuing up to loot outside
exactly.
a sports
and they
shop.
They say our young people have no discipline.
Yeah. Quite right.
6.5 minutes is a long time to wait in a queue, because if you've got organic food, that can go off.
I don't think that figure can be true, that 6.5 minutes, that's how long we can be patient for. But if that were true, this audience would never have got in.
Yeah. Do you know what? You don't have to arrive at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. We've never sold out. This show isn't that popular despite being free and one of the few things to do on a Thursday evening. Just pitch up at 7 o'clock, say you're on the guest list and they won't check. You'll be fine.
You can always sit where Jeremy's sitting.
I know a joke about a person buying things in a supermarket.
Mm.
There's a woman at the till and there's a man standing there and she's putting things. She says, individual pork pie, 1 pint of milk, small loaf of bread, ready meal for one. And she says, do you mind me asking, sir, are you a single gentleman? And he says, well, yes, how do you know? She says, because you're an ugly bastard.
That's a true story.
Yeah.
True story.
It was Streatham Sainsbury's, 1994. And it was Andrew Lloyd Webber.
According to a survey, Britons are losing the art of queuing and are prepared to wait just 6.5 minutes at the supermarket checkout before losing their temper. Statistically, the study also showed that people will wait for public transport for only 11 minutes. Of course, it depends where I'm going. If it's Croydon, I'm happy to wait. Respondents to the survey also described panpipe music as the most annoying type of music because it is. 2 points to Susan. Julia, who's in the dark when it comes to choosing a mate?
Apparently, male squid. Forgive me for not knowing the exact name of this particular kind of squid, but it's a squid that lives about 800 metres down where the sea and the ocean is pretty dark. And because it's very, very dark, apparently they can't often tell who to mate with, and they mate with just as many other male squid as they do with female squid, because they simply can't tell them apart. It's what's called the Mike Tyndall excuse.
Surely you could tell male squid from females. The females would be the ones doing the breaststroke and not getting their hair wet. Surely.
I understand that it's so dark that the male squid can't tell if it's a male or female squid. If it's that dark, how does he know it's a squid? Or are the ocean depths full of sort of slightly startled mackerel? what just happened?
How am I going to get this ink stain out of my lovely gills?
There's a programme on Sky Living called Dating in the Dark. Right? I know you've not seen it, Sandy, because
no.
You don't watch things like that. And they date each other in the dark. And it's based on personalities and not looks. And it's the same concept. Can you find someone attractive if you don't know what they look like? Now, what happens is they find each other attractive and then the light goes on and they go, oh, you're disgusting, and they never go out with each other.
In the documentary I saw, squid attack big submarines.
was Kirk Douglas in that documentary?
And then they say, oh, sorry, Kirk, I thought you was a woman.
A study into deep-sea squid has revealed that the male of the species are just as likely to mate with other males as females because they can't tell the difference in the dark.
I think David Cameron was probably the product of two male squid when, when you look at him closely.
Apparently the differences between the sexes is very slight, just like an Eastern European mixed shot put team. Because the squid have such a short reproductive period, couplings are usually indiscriminate and swift. Ooh, that's like a night out in a Wetherspoons. Before we reveal the final scores, let's hear the cuttings the teams have brought along, Mr. Hardy.
This was given to me by my friend Chris Dunham on my 50th birthday, but he also gave me a cake and some raspberries from his allotment. And it's from the Bishop Stortford Observer from the 30th of June of this year, and the headline reads, "Fine for student who had weed in his pants."
Ms. Kalman.
A bit cruel to give you that on your 50th birthday, though, a joke about incontinence.
Ms. Kelman.
This is from Connor Roach from the Imperial War Museum map. Crimes against humanity is not recommended for children under the age of 16.
Ms. Hartley Brewer.
This has been sent in by John McLaughlin from Beamish. He says travellers northbound on the A1 from Newark will see a huge sign saying, "Prepare to meet thy God." A smaller sign underneath says, "Barnsdale Cafe, first turning on the left."
Mr. Hamilton.
This is from the classified ads in The Lady, sent in by Sandra Lister. It says, "Isle of Wight, bed and breakfast, en suite double rooms, close to attractions, walks and quality beaches. Dog friendly, but sorry, no dogs."
Let's take a look at the final score. Jeremy and Susan have got 12 points, but this week's winners are Julia and Andy with 13. Before we leave you, here is a cutting from the Vancouver Metro sent to us by Elise Rhiannon.
A series of photographs have been released which capture Gabrielle Giffords' ecstatic mood at her husband's space shuttle launch in May. She got to see her husband successfully ride a rocket into space, her spokesman said. So who wouldn't be pleased?
And with that, goodbye.
Taking part in the news quiz were Jeremy Hardy, Susan Kalman, Julia Hartley Brewer and Andy Hamilton. In the chair was Sandy Toksvig, and the news was read by me, Cori Caulfield. The chair script was written by Simon Littlefield, Roderick Cooks and Danielle Ward, with additional material by Andy Walton and Toby Wilson. The producers were Victoria Lloyd and John Pocock.